Over the past three decades in development economics, billions of dollars and entire careers have been dedicated to generating rigorous evidence on cash transfers, education programs, health interventions, microfinance, and a whole suite of other development interventions. But the awkward fact, which is at the heart of this new series on evidence, is that we have very little evidence on how the evidence we've been producing actually makes it into policy. There is an evidence gap on evidence use. Despite this, there is a lot of talk about evidence-based policy, and it's the stated ambition of many donors, NGOs, and ministries. But we don't have a good understanding of how much, if at all, policymakers rely on evidence, when they use it, and the types of evidence they use. The list of questions goes on. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev. And in this series on evidence, we will be looking at both sides of the research to policy pipeline. The supply side, which is the researchers and institutions producing evidence, and the demand side, those policymakers and organizations who are, in theory at least, using it. And to open this series, I'm joined by Michelle Rao, who is a fellow at the Center for Global Development and is one of the small but growing number of researchers who are working on these questions of evidence use. Michelle, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thanks so much for having me.
To start with, I was wondering, what do we mean exactly when we say evidence, and what don't we mean?
So when I say evidence in this conversation, and also what I'm presuming you're saying when we're talking about this entire podcast, what I really mean is causal evidence. And in particular, what I'm thinking about is evidence that tells us about the impact of a particular event, a choice, or a policy on a given outcome that we care about. In practice, to get to that, we need to think about what we often call counterfactuals. And this is just a way of saying what would have been the outcome if this specific policy, event, or choice hadn't actually occurred. So let's put an example to this. Let's say that Alex graduates from high school, and we want to know the causal effect of high school graduation on lifetime earnings. The counterfactual here would be what Alex's earnings would have been if he hadn't graduated from high school. And what we mean by causal, in terms of estimating the causal effect of high school graduation, is really looking at the difference between the two numbers, what Alex actually earned after graduating from high school versus what he would have earned in this alternate reality if he hadn't graduated. The problem that we face when we're actually playing around with data is that we can't observe the counterfactual. By definition, Alex can only do one thing. He can either go to high school or not. So we can't observe what would have happened of something that did not even happen. So you never get to see this other world. So a large part of what causal research does in economics is really try to figure out ways around that problem, whether that's through running randomized controlled trials, so using experimental variation, or using methods like instrumental variables, differences in differences, regression discontinuity, what sometimes you'll hear people refer to as quasi-experimental methods. And all of these are ways to construct a credible counterfactual and therefore get at something that we can estimate and think of as a causal effect of the thing we're trying to understand.
So in economics, evidence equates to causality?
No, not at all. And I think that's an important clarification to be making up front. There's a large body of work in economics that we can think of as evidence, but isn't causal in the way that I've just described, and it's still incredibly valuable. This includes a lot of the most influential and descriptive work that we've seen in the past, 20, 30 years, like Raj Chetty's work, Claudia Golden's work, that's really descriptive and is also has been very influential in shaping our understanding of how the world works. Descriptive work helps us to understand the distributions, correlations, and patterns around the world. And that's a really core part of the evidence base in economics. It's important because it helps us to think through and build theories and models of how the world works. So it's definitely not the case that only causal evidence counts as evidence. But the reason we're focusing on causal evidence here is because the policy implications of causal evidence tend to be a bit more direct. if you can credibly say that this policy caused this outcome, then potentially there are clearer and more actionable policy decisions that we can be thinking about when what we care about is maybe policy impact and evidence use.
This is a bit of an ambitious question, but I was wondering if you could give us a sense of how the evidence base in development economics has grown and why that matters now when we are looking to study and understand evidence use.
Yeah, so I guess a large part of what we've described in terms of causal evidence is that the truth is over the past, 20, 30 years, there's just been a large growth of just causal evidence in empirical economics. This is evident when you look at the types of publications in economics now versus 30 years ago. And there's some studies on this that have some estimates which show that if you look at the top economic journals, over 80% of studies refer to some type of identification in their abstract. There's a lot more kind of causal claims being made in the evidence base in economics. This was really thanks to the development and growth of new empirical methods by labor economists in the late 70s and 80s. And they developed things and made things popular like experimental methods and all of those quasi-experimental methods that I was referring to just earlier, like differences in differences and instrumental variables and all of these things. I think within development economics, there was also a really large policy and institutional push towards a generation of causal evidence to really understand what works. And we see this with the explosion of RCTs, specifically in the field of development. Now, if we're thinking about why this matters for studying evidence use, this matters because we can only study evidence use if there's enough evidence to begin with. Right? And so it's kind of amazing now where we're at a stage where we have so much of a large evidence base, causal evidence base. And now we're at a point where we can actually look at all of this data, all of this evidence, to really try to think systematically about picking apart the things that matter for evidence use and also trying to understand, is it the case that people actually use evidence to make policy decisions?
What are the ways that causal evidence in theory may affect policy?
Some things that are potentially harder to quantify. So I think generally we believe that when you're generating an evidence base, evidence in general changes potentially the way we think about a problem, changes the way we might think about evidence in general, the way institutions and organizations actually engage with evidence. More concretely, there's a few kind of specific decisions that we often talk about when we're talking about evidence use and policy. The first is program adoption. So having data and causal evidence on which programs work might help you to understand and think about which programs you actually want to adopt and start up. The second is things such as program design. So ideas on, data on whether a program works or not tells you how you might want to change things in your program, the way it's delivered, what you should do with the program, depending on whether it's working as well or delivering the types of outcomes that you intended for it to deliver in the start. And the third thing, which we'll speak about a bit later, is really on spending decisions. So this idea that when you have an evaluated program and you have estimates of how well it works, it can potentially help you decide whether you want to spend more on the program or spend less. This can translate to large scale-ups of pilots, or it can also mean that if a pilot doesn't work as well as you were intending it to, or you wanted it to, you could have decisions to scale down programs that potentially don't work as well.
Yeah, so there's clearly a lot of mechanisms at play here. And it's a messy and hard topic to grapple with and research, which is something that you took on in your own work, where you study one of the channels through which evidence might affect policy. What were you looking at specifically?
In my research, I specifically focused on this spending channel. So really, I was looking at the relationship between evaluation outcomes and spending on the evaluated programs. And this is underlying this idea, or really trying to think about whether resources are flowing to higher impact programs over time. in one of my papers, I basically study this in the context of conditional cash transfers in Latin America and the Caribbean. And this is a great setting to think about this because anyone involved in the development econ space knows that CCTs are super widespread, but they're also really highly and frequently evaluated over time as a program overall. I find that within Latin America and the Caribbean, there was a total of 128 program evaluations of the causal impact of conditional cash transfers on specific poverty-related outcomes just over the period of 2000 to 2015. This covers 31 evaluated conditional cash transfers across 17 countries. And what's really striking in this region is that more than half of these evaluations are actually done in collaboration with government. So this is a setting in which policymakers are aware of the evidence. In the study, what I really do is I put together a data set of all of these 128 program evaluations, and I match this to spending on the same cash transfers that are being evaluated and try to think about whether these resources are really flowing to higher impact programs.
What did you find? Was there anything that particularly stood out to you?
Overall, I find that there's no relationship between evaluation outcomes and changes in spending on the same programs that have been evaluated. And the only exception for this is when evaluations are really timely and politically aligned. I can break this down a little bit for you to tell you a bit more about what I mean by this. So the first thing you can do when you have all of these evaluations is look at the relationship between individual evaluation outcomes and subsequent spending. And what I find here is that for each individual study that comes out, regardless of whether you look at the framing of the research results or the size of the research results, there's no relationship between individual evaluations and subsequent changes in spending. This means that policymakers aren't, you know, increasing their spending on the cash transfer in periods where evaluation outcomes are particularly good. And they're also not withdrawing their spending in periods where evaluation outcomes are particularly bad. Now, one thing you might think is that policymakers are really sophisticated and they want to learn and wait for the entire body of evidence to come out before they make changes to their spending. And if that were the case, you would see a relationship between this aggregate evidence base as entire literature grows and aggregate spending on cash transfers in that country. I use a Bayesian hierarchical model, which is common in meta-analysis, to basically estimate what you might take away from the entire aggregate evidence base. And here, what I find is that there's a zero relationship between this aggregate findings in each country and spending on the cash transfers at the country level. The last part of my paper that I look at is really looking at sources of heterogeneity that might matter for explaining this relationship. So we can think about maybe subsets of evidence that might be more policy relevant or maybe are easier to use for the policymaker. Potentially, we might care about papers that are more credible and internally valid, so published in better journals. We might think about papers that are more generalizable and applicable to different settings. Or we might think about studies that maybe are more actionable, so more easy to act upon once you get the results. What I find is that the main thing that seems to matter is that evaluations, when they're done really quickly and when they're attributable to the political party in power, for that subset of evaluations, you find a positive relationship between evaluation outcomes and spending. And so that really suggests that understanding timeliness and also the political costs to evidence use is really important.
Yeah, so I guess the overall finding you have is a bit worrying or disconcerting for the idea that evidence is this important factor in policymakers' decision making, right? Because you're basically finding that overall there's not this relationship between evidence and then subsequent spending decisions. You talked about there some of the cases where it does seem like evidence is moving the needle and impacting spending decisions. I was wondering, were you able to dig into the times where you were finding this null effect of evidence, and what sort of reasons or theories did you have as to why evidence wasn't actually moving the needle in those cases?
So the way I interpret the results is really that there's political costs to using evidence. So this is a setting in which policymakers are highly trained. I have a sample where over 50% of the ministers of finance have PhDs. Most of these PhDs are in economics. Most of these PhDs are from the US. My reading of the findings is that even if it were the case that policymakers were reading the evidence and they fully understood the evidence and they were learning, there's lots of political costs to actually implementing and changing the policy in line with the evidence base. And this is particularly the case if you're thinking about something like cash transfers, which are really highly politically salient. If you're speaking to any, you know, political scientist, they'll say that you can't withdraw any spending because that's just not politically palatable, especially for a cash transfer. And, you know, it's also potentially hard to increase spending as well. So my reading of the relationship is really, my reading of the results is really that there are just costs to using evidence, which we need to better understand and pick apart and engage with when we're trying to understand evidence use. Relatedly, kind of the last finding that I described where we find a positive relationship specifically for timely evidence, I think that again points to this cost story where as it takes longer and longer for evidence to come out, there's less of an incentive for a policymaker to act on that. And it's harder to use that evidence really to act as well because there's just increasing costs over time to actually acting in line with the evidence base.
And digging into that point a bit further on the kind of timeliness of evidence being important, you show that evidence is more actionable when the same party is in power during both the period of evaluation and then the publication of the evidence. I guess that suggests governments are partly maybe also using evaluations as a way of kind of claiming credit and proving the effectiveness of their programs rather than just purely as a learning exercise. Do you think that's a widespread dynamic? And is it necessarily a bad thing if it's still producing or helping to produce better policy outcomes?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point and interpretation of the findings. One way to think about it is when the same political party is in power during the evaluation period and publication, it means that the evaluation results are saying something about the policy that actually can be attributable and belongs to the person in power, right? So the way I interpreted it, interpret this is kind of something about attribution matters because you actually want the government to have ownership over these results. They want it matters for us that they should feel like this is something, this paper is telling them something, or this evaluation outcome is telling them something about something that they're doing. So one way to interpret it is that it's because it's attributable, it's actionable because it feels like something that I can claim ownership over and say that it's something that I have an incentive to act in line with in terms of the evidence. So in this sense, I think governments wanting to claim credit or caring about the research results and having buy-in isn't a bad thing. In this sense, I don't think it's a bad thing. And we can also link it with another work within this area by Alex von Argent. She has a paper which also shows that when you have co-generation with policymakers, you're more likely to see evidence uptake. So all of this really points towards, you know, having some type of buy-in, having governments care about research and the research results matters, obviously with the caveat that you still need to preserve the independence of the research, right? And so when used well, I don't think this is a bad thing. And in particular, this means that when a program works well, it makes sense that you want to be able to claim credit and you want to be able to act on that. And on the flip side, I think this also means, hopefully, that if the evidence shows that if something worked badly, then you also have an incentive to act on that as well.
And the paper we've been discussing and your work is part of this growing body of evidence in economics, which is looking at these questions of evidence use in policy. Could you tell us a bit more about this other work? You mentioned Alex Bonagent's paper there Are there any other kind of people and or papers that you've been reading? And does this work tend to be pretty similar to the type of exercise you did, or does it differ quite a lot from what you've been working on?
It's a really exciting area to work in because it's been very much growing over the past few years. The most famous paper that people probably know is probably the Brazilian mayor's paper. They have a two-part paper with Brazilian municipalities to really think about measuring mayor's demand and response to evidence. And they also have the second component where they experiment with the mayors and tell them about evidence on using taxpayer reminder letters and basically show that randomly informing these mayors about this information increases the probability that the policy is implemented. So that one's quite positive in terms of its view on evidence use. Beyond that, there's, I would split the literature in two broad brackets. So one part of the literature really looks at measuring policymaker beliefs and demand for evidence use. And this includes this original study that looked at development policy professionals and measured their behavioral biases. So that paper is by Benuri et al. And they basically find that policy professionals are subject to biases with framing, and that really affects their decision-making processes. And then there's this more recent literature with Vivalt and Coville, Matti Toma, Elizabeth Bell, where they're really looking at measuring different types of policymaker preferences and the ways in which they update their beliefs in the lab. A second part of the literature, which aligns a bit more with what I've talked about in terms of my study, is really looking at these observed changes in evidence use, observed uses of evidence in real life. Here, we actually find pretty consistent findings overall, where there's potentially lower evidence use than we potentially might believe. So one study by Stefano Della Vigna and Elizabeth Linos really looks at nudge experiments within nudge units in the US. And they basically find that only 25% of nudge experiments are subsequently implemented. This is a setting in which, you know, they're actually generating the evidence. There should be institutional demand for evidence use. And even then, you find that the size of the effects of what people find really don't predict subsequent policy implementation. One paper that I mentioned earlier was by Alex Bonargent, and she looks specifically at research projects using IGC data and basically finds that you have higher implementation and policy impact when you have co-created projects. And that really aligns a little bit with what I've been describing earlier in terms of the importance of really engaging with the political circumstances under which evidence is generated. I think generally, in terms of how this relates with my work, it's really exciting that we're able to start studying this in practice in terms of what actually happens. And my paper differs in the sense that I'm looking at one specific channel, which is looking at the relationship between evidence and spending. So whereas other studies focus on things like policy adoption, really, spending is a potentially easier margin to adjust on because you're not starting a completely different program. Another thing that I find really exciting is that because cash transfers are repeatedly evaluated over time, we can think about evidence use first by looking at what is the relationship between one paper, one evaluation outcome, and changes in spending or some evidence outcome that you might care about. But because there's entire literature of cash transfers, I'm able to use that to really think about how people might learn in a more sophisticated way from an entire body of evidence.
Yeah, and there's also, on this topic of evidence use, a lot of evidence that is not necessarily empirical, but still might be useful. So qualitative work that maybe interviews people who've been senior policymakers asking about how they use evidence. There's a lot of institutional knowledge that has built up over time in different organizations that are looking to use evidence to change or sway policy, which might be useful for us when we're thinking about these broader questions of evidence use. I was wondering if there was anything you've come across in that sphere, kind of away from the kind of econometric paper, but still useful, that you thought would be worth highlighting.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot we can learn about this based on people's institutional knowledge and experiences actually working to get evidence used. And in doing this work, which is very quantitative, I've also talked to a lot of people and done a lot of interviews to try to understand their models of the world and how they think this works. A few things that come out a lot. First is the importance of relationships and trust in terms of building these relationships with policymakers. That means that they trust you and they want to, you're their person that they want to go to when they want to get evidence and when they want to figure out what matters. People also talk a lot about the importance of timing, which comes across also quantitatively in my work, where it's hard and important to make sure you're just there at the right time and giving evidence at critical junctures in which you can actually act on it as a policymaker. Those are two things that I think come up repeatedly, regardless of who you talk to. And I personally would find it really exciting to, you know, start collecting more data and build on the evidence base to try to look at this systematically when we're looking at the data.
Yeah, I think it'd be, because I've also heard very frequently that essentially a lot of it comes down to relationships between kind of senior researchers who get to know people who are in positions of power making decisions, and they kind of act as that bridge between the academic world and the policy world, right? And they're the key way in which evidence does get filtered through directly to the important people making the big decisions. It'd be interesting. I'm not sure how exactly you would study that empirically, but it'd definitely be interesting to learn more about it, kind of in terms of trying to quantify their importance and the role they play. And then, yeah, timing is the other one that I've also frequently heard. And there's been a lot of good writing on it. It's great that kind of is something that you're able to explore in your research. And I guess it comes about in two ways, right? There's the timing in terms of if you're doing an evaluation, make sure you do it quickly enough so that when you deliver the results, the people who commissioned it are still around and are accountable for what you find. But then there's also the kind of implication for picking your moments. And if you've built up this big evidence base over time, realistically, there might be a specific moment, a specific debate, maybe even a news article that causes a lot of public attention on an issue. And then that becomes your moment to kind of strike and say, okay, well, we've built up all this evidence. Here's what we know about this topic, which is now in the news because of a documentary or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you're thinking about timing, it's important to think about it in the context of the political cycle and just political events that matter.
And there are now a number of large development organizations. You can think of JPAL, IPA, 3IE. The World Bank has its own evaluation units, as do many major donors, whose institutional existence almost seems to depend on the premise that rigorous evaluation is important and does matter for policy. I mean, given my job, it's probably not a surprise that I find that to be a reasonable premise. But do you think it at all creates a bias in how the field of economics kind of studies and communicates evidence use?
I think so, yes. And that's because, you know, as I put myself in this bucket as well, as development economists, we tend to approach the problem from a very technocratic lens. And there is this belief that if you provide good evidence on what works, then policymakers will use it. In practice, we know that the context in which evidence lands is often very complex. It's really messy. Policymakers come with their own priors and beliefs about the world. And even if they want to learn and want to use the evidence, they're going to face different incentives and cost to actually changing policies in line with the evidence base. A lot of the people within these organizations that you mentioned know this, and they're working really with policymakers to think about new ways of communicating evidence, new models of partnerships with policymakers to increase evidence use. And I find this really exciting. And what I think is really important is to actually study the impact of these initiatives to figure out what works to increase evidence use. And in addition to that, like you allude to in your question, I think we need to be aware of what our blind spots are. We need to know what we don't know. And so part of that means that we need to collect data to figure out what's actually happening now, what policymakers care about, and that will help us to identify where the bottlenecks are and what the likely solutions are going to be.
Yeah, and I think on that last point you made, the more I've looked into this area of kind of how evidence is used, which is obviously important for my role at VoxDev, where I guess our goal is to put evidence in people's hands so that it can hopefully get used and improve policy. The takeaway I've had is that actually there's just a real lack of even kind of descriptive data on, okay, here's how many policymakers have used certain types of evidence, or here are examples of when evidence was used by policymakers to do XYZ. I guess J-PAL actually has some nice case studies on that now, but there does seem to be a real, even just like at a fundamental level, a real lack of understanding of kind of where evidence sits in the policy process. And I think it'll be really valuable to even have some of that more descriptive data or work as well. And in terms of the moment we find ourselves in right now, where research budgets and development budgets are being squeezed, it does feel like understanding how evidence is used, particularly kind of the big base of evidence we've built up in specific areas, is particularly important. I think you probably agree with that, but I was wondering if you could kind of expand on why right now seems to be a good time to be working on evidence use.
For me, like with tightened aid budgets, there's even more pressure for development agencies to be effective in their spending and to make sure they're achieving as much as they can with the limited amount of money that they have. Within this context, the value of evidence is higher than ever, right? We know that evidence can help people decide which programs are the most impactful, what's the most cost-effective, how should you implement these in ways that are most effective. And having this evidence can help people to ensure that they're doing the most they can with their limited budgets. On the flip side, we know also from the data, this doesn't always happen, and it's not something that we can take as given. So that's where we come back to really studying and understanding evidence use, because in addition to evidence generation, we need to also invest in understanding how governments are using evidence and ways to actually improve this. Really, I think what's really exciting is that as you're understanding how people use evidence, this really has the potential to have generalizable findings that can help existing, you know, development and research budgets go further in terms of their policy impact.
And looking forward, given that this is an area that you're actively working on, if you were acting as kind of the general manager in charge of understanding evidence use, where would you be directing the overall efforts of the community working on these problems? What do you see as the most important questions here where you would like to see this research agenda focused?
So we've touched on these quite a bit in our conversation already, but let me put everything together so we can think about them in one place. So the first is, like you've said already, understanding baselines. So first of all, I think to study this, we need to understand how much policymakers are already using evidence, and really building a data set and a database where we can at least do have some descriptive facts and understand what's actually happening on aggregate with this large evidence base that we've been able to build. And that can help us to identify, you know, what is the state of the world that we are in. The second thing that I would love to see more work on is really on this political economy side of evidence use. So really understanding what are the circumstances under which evidence enters. That means that we should better understand the preferences, the beliefs, the costs, you know, the incentives to using evidence, and also specifically understand the beliefs and costs and incentives of the policymakers that are actually using the evidence. So illuminating that in terms of who are these policymakers, what do they care about, what do they believe, I think would be super interesting and super valuable. And in addition to that, also understanding across all of these different institutions, you know, what are the systems under which evidence operates? You know, what existing kind of incentives and systems exist to support evidence use, if at all. The last thing I'd love to see more work on is really on the solution side. So testing and rigorously testing new solutions and innovative ways and methods of engaging policymakers, of creating research, and also of creating partnerships to basically increase evidence use.
Thanks so much. So this series from here on out will be a slightly different to the usual format, as I'll be hosting each episode rather than being joined by a co-host. But I do want to thank Michelle, not just for this conversation, but for the conversations we've had, which have helped me to scope out the rest of the episodes, think through this topic, and plan what this series is going to cover. In the episodes ahead, we're going to be looking at both sides of this problem, as I've discussed. We're going to be hosting a range of people who've worked on the research and the policy side. On the supply side, which is kind of the research side, we're going to be thinking about how research is designed, communicated, and funded, and how incentives in the academic system shape what gets studied. On the demand side, what policymakers actually want from researchers, how organizations learn, and what it would take to build more capacity for governments to use evidence in the developing world. I hope you will stay with us for these episodes. We're really looking forward to them. This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our Substack. And our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.